Hello, and thanks for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm your host, Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network. You're about to hear a conversation that took place at the Special Competitive Studies Project's AI Expo, featuring Silverado Policy Accelerator co-founder and executive chair, Maureen Hinman. She's a veteran of the Commerce Department, where she traveled the world representing the United States on global trade negotiations, from critical minerals to the environment. We talked about all of that, including, of course, competition with China. Enjoy. Okay, everyone, here we are at Special Competitive Studies Project's AI Expo. Let's hear it. Yes, and you are cheering for the right person because Maureen Hinman is my guest. Maureen is USTR veteran, and everyone knows what that is here. I don't need to explain that. She's executive chair of the Silverado Policy Accelerator. Congratulations on that. And I'm so glad to have you here. I had the honor of going to your conference last week, and you gave this report on where things are in America with American security, with trade, with so many issues. And I'd really like to start right there and bring us up to date on where we are. And then we can talk about what you see in the future.
Okay, sure.
That's not wide enough, is it?
Yeah, no, fire away.
Well, you specifically talked about the challenges that the U.S. has, some that we're doing well in, some that we're not doing well in. But let's start with trade.
Look, you know, I think that what the average man on the street doesn't understand about trade is that aside from some of the noise around the tariff war, we're going through a global transformation in how we do trade policy. And a lot of that is because the existing systems are really designed for market economies and for democracies. And we have very large economies in the system now that are neither. And in order to have a set of rules that is predictable, that is companies can bank on, that is fair, most importantly, and that creates value for those market economies, the rules need to be adjusted. And so the first thing one needs to do is to build some leverage. And so you've seen that both in regards to this sort of like number soup, I like to say, on investigations and tariff actions, whether it's 301, 232, 201.
Write that down, 301, 232, 201. Okay, keep going.
It's not my phone number, I promise. You don't want that anyways. So the first thing one needs to do is both build leverage and set a fact pattern. And I think that, Ambassador Greer, both in this, who's the USTR, both in this administration and in his role in the previous Trump administration, and frankly, a lot of these policies were carried through the Biden administration, has been pretty consistent on thinking about setting that fact pattern and building that leverage so new rules can be established.
You guys live at the crossroads of national security, trade, energy. And again, the world is in tumult.
Yes.
So how do you move things forward?
Excellent question. Look, you know, I tend to, when we look at sort of the schema of policy, and all of these policy areas are extremely complex, as are, if you look at the individual industries we're trying to create impact around, they themselves are also incredibly complex. And so you have to kind of look at the full constellation of issues and then try to figure out which issues are pivotable, right? And so when I worked in the government, I used to run an industry advisory committee, and I used to talk about what policy smart guidelines were for making good policy. And some of it's just like classic Overton window, but my personal smart guidelines are specific, measurable, actionable, realistic, timely. So realistic and timely really deals with like what can the government actually do, and does this policy make sense right now? And if you're kind of disciplining yourself around what you can actually get done, that's how you figure out where you need to focus your energy, because otherwise you're just running uphill.
Well, you were dealing with energy and the environment, two of the most difficult issues. And then you overlay AI and everything that's going on in this building and around the world. Mm-hmm. So it's so, I hate to put you on the spot.
Put me on the spot.
It's so incredibly complex. How do you move even an inch? And where do you today see that movement and the opportunity?
So I think the opportunity is in a couple of focusing on a couple of things. Again, you can't excel at things that you're not really investing in. So on the energy front, you know, we've called this just sort of a real emphasis on clean baseload. And what that means is large energy facilities that produce energy all the time, and ideally in a clean way. So clean baseload really is going to be just a couple of things. It's going to be nuclear energy. It's going to be hydro energy, geothermal, and gas-fired power plants with carbon capture. Now, there are some technological barriers around that, but really focusing on that clean baseload makes a lot of other things possible in the economy, including AI. And then the sort of frontier energy technologies are deep well geo and my personal favorite, fusion energy, because fusion is very near. Next five years.
Yeah, that's game changing. I mean, fusion.
Game changing.
Right.
Because the magic on fusion, if you don't know the difference between fission and fusion, fission energy is easy to start and hard to stop. That's why you have meltdown risk, which, by the way, with the newer reactors, even with new nuclear, they're so much safer than the previous generation, and some of them are impossible.
They're still not accepted, right?
No, because people think about the minute instances of catastrophe and don't look at the broader sort of energy instance. So let me ask you this. Of all the ways that we generate energy, what contributes the most casualties? How the most people who are hurt or die?
No idea.
Solar energy.
Really?
Yeah, people fall off roofs. Kind of a lot. I mean, it's not funny, but you just have to think about,
right. You just
gigawatt hour generated. You just right. wouldn't think
but
it
who,
was it.
But who's moving on nuclear? I mean, we hear the administration talk about it. There's a lot of talk. There's talk about nuclear in space. Where are you actually seeing? Because you're measuring what people are actually doing.
Yeah. So there's a ton of companies that have capitalized on new models that are pretty far along. And there is, of course, a large reactor that's going into Wyoming. It's going to be the first one that we've built in many, many years. We're also seeing in the nuclear sector is a lot of, instead of decommissioning, recommissioning nuclear plants.
Pennsylvania.
Because the infrastructure is there. And, if you think about sort of financial efficiencies, it costs, I think a little bit less even, maybe the same, to recommission a plant and get another 80 years of energy out of it as opposed to decommissioning it and just letting that become a brownfield site where, who knows what you're going to do with it after the fact.
Well, I want to turn to critical minerals.
Okay.
Because one of the things you talked about in your report is that the deficiency here in the U.S., but there is a little progress. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we've actually seen some serious headway in the past couple of years. So first of all, rare earths are always the point of discussion across the media and in the halls of power because they really are very important. But what you might not know is that we are sitting on what kind of lovingly known as the Saudi Arabia of rare earths. The Mountain Pass mine in California is one of the largest rare earth deposits on the planet, and it is an active mine. But this mine has continuously been throttled by Chinese policies designed to put it out of business, frankly.
How do you unwind that?
I mean, the past few years, the government has stepped in, both with contracts, which is very helpful because it does set an operating floor for businesses, and MP Materials, who operates Mountain Pass, has also become a shareholder, and so I think that does send a kind of a strong message to China that these are our companies and we're moving forward. And the other thing to know is that many of these companies, there are several others, are also getting into the processing game, which is really where the bottleneck is in minerals and mining. It's not,
So it isn't just about finding them, it's the process manufacturing?
It's mining the ores, separation, and then actual processing into usable minerals. And so that processing bottleneck, China tends to control between 75 and 98% for some things like graphite of the world processing capacity. And so that's a choke point. It's a big problem. But we've, you know, slowly but surely are turning the ship. And then I think the third frontier on minerals is just getting much smarter about recovery at end of life and making sure that we've got a recycling technology. For instance, in the AI space, you know, we're sending a lot of used electronics over to China. They are pulling those high quality materials out of those electronics and using them in their own sector. We should be keeping those resources at home. It is a resource.
And who should be doing that? Again, is that government or is it private industry?
I'm a free market person. So I tend to think that government should set good incentives and the rules of the road and only intervene when absolutely necessary, when there's market distortions.
But they haven't intervened and everything's kind of where it was, right?
Yeah, everything is mostly where it is. I mean, I think that the challenge with the with recovery in materials is that we need sort of a thinking paradigm. We need a paradigm shift. We need to think about these things differently because at least in international trade and definitely in many corners, they're treated like garbage. And look, there is definitely hazardous wastes or hazardous materials inside those materials. But creating economic incentives to recover those materials, and to recover those materials in the United States makes it much more likely that they will be handled in a safe and an environmentally sound way.
And when they go back to China, they're reused?
When they go back to China, they generally are either demanufactured and then the materials are aggregated and recovered for reuse.
And are they pulling data out of any of those materials?
I would assume they would be. I mean...
That makes sense. All right.
I hit all my old drives with a hammer before I
received really?
Them. Yeah.
Oh, well, when they give me the drive back here, I'll do that too.
Just hit it with a hammer.
Just hit it.
Not that we give up any drives in our house. We're very cyber security oriented.
Okay. So let's talk about data centers because now it's become a political football. Mm-hmm. You've been talking about how important it is to have the energy resources mm-hmm. and that they're U.S. based, but there's been a real political, and I know you're not a political pundit, but there's been a real sense that AI has been taken over by this negative point of view on data centers. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is a way to move forward with this kind of power in communities? You live in Virginia. Mm-hmm. It's an issue in Virginia, or is it overblown?
I think that we need to really be much more clear with local communities of what the value proposition is of a data center. And on its face, it doesn't look that valuable. You know, there's a bunch of jobs that go in early on. And then there are, you know, 20 to 50 jobs to operate the facility, which is, by the way, they don't take up a huge footprint compared to some other you know, forms of economics. And actually, in fact, I did a little research before I came out today. The number of operating jobs in a data center is slightly more or the same as a solar power plant. And the average solar power plant is going to take up far, far, far more resources in terms of land, minerals. Probably not minerals. I'm sorry. I'll take that back. But definitely land and also water resources. Whereas a data center is going to create circular water processing, and they're going to bring in a bunch of energy. Now, I think the fear around the data centers and energy is that it's going to raise local prices. And this is why I say that I don't think we've done an adequate job of talking about the value proposition. Because generally, hyperscalers, when they build a data center, they are bringing in their own energy or they are subsidizing energy for the local community. That is baseload energy because to operate a data center, especially an AI data center, you can't have any lapses in energy. So that is 24/7 delivery of energy. That makes for a much more secure and grid for the people in the community. And the other thing to know, and again, back to the value proposition, is that if you are bringing in water, which you need for a a data center, and you're bringing in energy and also the conducting the conducting infrastructure that you need to move that energy around, you have now created the foundational the circumstances by which lots of other economic activities can happen there. So that's the beginning of maybe it's, you know, data center is going to employ a few people. But if you have a lot of energy going to a certain location and you have water and you've got that infrastructure, other businesses are going to spring up because there is going to be economies of scale. And so I think that some of the value proposition is not just talking about the center itself, but the infrastructure built up around the center and how much economic activity that can generate.
Well, your perfect example is Northern Virginia, where there have been data centers for, I don't know, how many years? A couple decades.
Absolutely. Right. And you see a bunch of stuff springing up around them, and you certainly have, you know, with these AI data centers, the amount of waste heat that they have, there's lots of economic opportunity to use the data center as your basis for a small development zone for lots of different, you know, whether it's light manufacturing or other types of economic activity.
Okay, one of my favorite parts of your report was you identified three flawed assumptions about market competition with the PRC. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through this?
I sure can.
You had a lot of facts. And talking about how policymakers don't really look at it the way they should.
Yeah.
Market, I remember one of the key parts was that the market will not tell the whole story. You can't just leave
that's
it
right.
to a free market, even though you're a free marketer.
That's number one. So the idea for many years, especially with the competition with China, people were like, oh, we'll outcompete. We have better innovation. We're smarter. And that just hasn't come to bear, because at the end of the day, the way that you create a good market economy is by having good rules. We're a rules-based society. And
But they're not.
So you can steal IP and merge it together and innovate faster. Because if you or I comes up with a clever idea and somebody else owns a piece of IP, I have to buy that. Right?
Right.
I have to lease that. I have to work out a deal. I may not be able to get my hands on it. And that's just one small example of the market distortions that are so vast. There's no innovation solution to overcome, for instance, a 20% energy benefit by just not doing any air pollution control. Right? That's like, you can't overcome a 20% margin in most businesses, let alone small margin businesses. So that's number one. And number two is that we have friends and allies. And I always say we have a lot of frenemies, because we've seen this pattern where you've got this big bad actor. And our expectation is that we'll be this unified block with all of our friends and allies. And that expectation has fallen short, because we've seen friends and allies sort of arbitrate around our complaints and benefit. We've seen friends and allies try to pick up the excess demand that comes from us saying no on things. And so the U.S. has really stood alone for a long time. And so this big assumption is that you have to enforce good behavior. You cannot just expect it. And that's unfortunate, but it's true. And then the third, I think, big fallacy, big lie that we tell ourselves is that no is not an outcome. And what I mean by that is that in government, and I worked in government for many years, we often say, oh, well, we need an outcome. We can't say no. Well, look, you can be a system maker or a system taker. And if you are always going along to get along, you're going to be a system taker. Because the obstinacy of our adversary is much more resolute, because they don't have the democracy problem. People can't say what they think. And so we have to be really clear about what our goals are and the kind of system we want. And we have to show up to both at home and internationally and be very clear about what the U.S. will and won't accept.
Well, the two issues you care most about, energy and environment, are in direct conflict, let's be honest. In the world we live in today, as we look at AI, et cetera, do you disagree?
I disagree. So I'm much more optimistic on this than the average person. I actually think so AI is going to create and is already creating massive demand for energy. And this demand is coming from hyperscalers who have demand for clean energy. And so at the end of the day, I played with the numbers today a little bit. By 2030, we're going to easily need 800 to 1,000 more power plants in America alone. I mean, that's big power plants. That's 100 megawatt power plants. So if you think about that, the existing resources are not going to supply them. And so you have to think about some of these really valuable baseload alternatives in a meaningful way. And so my sense on this, on energy and climate in particular, is that this demand is going to create a bunch of new energy solutions and deploy them very quickly, which is what you need to solve the climate problem. And, you know, I've been dragged through the mud before on this. I say it all the time. You know, we have a gas-based economy. So does the EU. The US is one of the most carbon-efficient economies in the world. We don't tell ourselves that, but it is true. Dollars to donuts. And now the reason why is because we switched from coal and oil to gas. And so to the degree that we can switch our technologies to these clean baseload technologies, and I think it's within years, not within decades, with that new demand and those new sort of footprints, I think that some of like small nuclear and small fusion, I mean, fusion's amazing because you have this ability to decouple energy from geography, and that's never been done in history. So you can put these things anywhere.
And do you think the U.S. is closest?
Yes, on fusion, I think we're closest, but I think we're a little ahead on AI. I think we're fairly ahead on fusion, but we don't actually know, because again, closed society, we don't know what's actually happening. But the pattern, what worries me is the pattern with China has always been is that we've been way ahead on innovation and we get there first and we're like so proud of ourselves. And then they take that technology, build it better and commercialize it faster. And we're kind of, you know, left in the lurch. So, but I was going to say, I'm very optimistic because in the short term, you know, what you end up doing is if we build a bunch of energy infrastructure that's clean in America, then we have a lot of gas resources that we can export abroad, and we can transition we can transition infrastructure in other countries that are maybe like need to get off of coal. And so it is a bridge fuel, and that creates a sort of a ripple effect that can not just help the United States decarbonize, but the world decarbonize at a faster rate.
And what about the implication of the war in Ukraine and the effect on Europe? I mean, hasn't that sort of thrown some of these energy ideas up in the air and investment?
On Ukraine, yeah, I think it's been really it's been very interesting to see Europe's reaction, because prior to the invasion, you had this sort of general sense that there was one right way to decarbonize, and it was through renewables, and it was going to be fine. And don't, and by the way, ignore all the gas we're importing for our gas-fired power plants. Look the other way. We burn a lot of trash here too. Look the other way. But there was a little bit of magical thinking going on. And now I think that there's, you know, a few more realists in the European continent, in part because they lost their gas supply. And so we stepped in and were able to increase production. And frankly, like, it's one of these things that, like, we don't talk about it enough. How quickly the United States put up and developed the LNG shipment infrastructure to keep the lights on and the heat on that winter in Europe, I mean, was a real gift to our friends in Europe, and an amazing feat. But we did it because we're actually kind of good at, you know, dealing with fuels. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing is just this idea that these intermittent sources are going to somehow create enough energy to power modern society. And I think the bubble for many smart people in Europe really burst, because it's always been fairly inefficient. It's always been a little bit of a pipe dream, the idea of a diurnal solar, like say in the cloudier parts of Germany, or, you know, wind is actually very effective in many
parts. What happened to wind?
Wind is great, but it takes a long time to build. And it's very hard because, you know, the most valuable wind power is offshore, and offshore you know, whether you're in the US or you're in the EU, you're anywhere in the world, once you build something offshore, you're dealing with a bunch of other sort of, you know, naval regulations and rules and navigation.
Are there too many rules all the way around? Is that why they're so slow to build, whether it's nuclear or...
Yeah, I think there. I think permitting is long overdue in this country and most countries.
There's legislation pending, but it doesn't seem to move very far.
Yeah, hopefully we'll move soon. I mean, I think some of the urgency will.
Do you think people are moving as if it's urgent? Because we talk about it, you talk about it, we talked about it at your conference the entire time. But I'm just curious, because I'm not inside. Mm-hmm. Are people moving that fast? Is there anything else you'd like to see them do?
I think people are, there's a strong commitment and there's quite a bit of interest. I think everyone recognizes the problem, which is good.
Right. One.
But what and where and how, I think is going to be the question. And my sense on rewriting rules and doing things like permitting reform is we have to kind of start from scratch and talk about the economy we have today. And what our needs are.
Got to tell a story.
As opposed to the
story.
I mean, like, look, let's.
No, I'm saying your story, I mean, the story of the U.S. and advancement, mm-hmm. and you called your conference the new era of America, right? So here's what happened here, and here's what we need to do. I feel like it's a marketing issue.
Yeah, part of it's a marketing issue. Yeah, I agree. And also, it's, you know, I have a great story about this, in fact, that, you know, there are, our water infrastructure is so old, right? Our grandparents, and sometimes great-grandparents, for all you young people in the audience, gave us this massive infrastructure investment during the Depression and right after World War II. And we have not updated that infrastructure kind of since then. And infrastructure only lasts so long. Everything man-made breaks. Everything man-made breaks. Know that up front. So there are literally pipes in Boston that are from the colonial period that they're still using, that are made of wood. No joke. Just to deliver water, right? And so we need to think about where we are today. We're hitting our 250 birthday and what we actually need for the economy we have today and the economy we want tomorrow. And some of that is wiping clean some of our own, you know, magical thinking. So for instance, the NEPA policies, I mean, I'm not a big fan of NEPA. And if you're not familiar with NEPA, it is an environmental review process for permitting that comes from the federal government. And it was invented at a time before there was actual strong environmental legislation in America. So NEPA should have sunsetted as soon as the environmental legislation was put in place, because the environmental legislation is more than enough. EPA is a powerful agency, despite, you know,
still is.
Absolutely. I mean, because it's the law. They can pull your permit. They can pull your permit for anything. They can turn the lights off for anything. They can pull your ability to use water, and you need water for everything. And so if you're misbehaving, and builders and, you know, EPCs and other and firms who operate know this. They are really good at following a regulation. What they want is not this sort of, you know, I used to call it when I worked in government, like a little bit of government's like the craptastic mansion. So we all know like what you, like, you know, I grew up in a very, very like middle class place. And so you've got the people who have like the smallish house, and instead of buying a new house, they like put another, you know, addition on it. Right. And then a few years later, they put another addition on it. And you keep having this, and it ends up being this kind of like craptastic mansion where the rooms don't really make sense. There's a bunch of duplication. Things don't link up because you're not thinking of it as a system. You're just like adding on. And part of that is the problem of government because, you know, we have luckily a system that lets us share power and change power, right? That's built in, and I wouldn't give it up for the world. But we have to understand that sort of weakness in our system and think about how we end up applying in our regulatory structure a system's way of thinking and managing rules that is that comports with how industry works. And also, frankly, like trust industry. Like they will comply. And so NEPA, get rid of it, because you already have an environmental compliance. Just you know, assume that they will comply. If you have already built five facilities in America and you operate them with a good record, I'm going to assume that the sixth facility that you build, you will also operate it with a good record. Why am I forcing you to sit in an 8-year environmental process, permitting process, you know? And this doesn't preclude anything like, you know, doing your environmental review of the site and all of those things. That's already baked into the law.
Well, this is partially why people don't trust government and they feel like it's not working for them. Because why should it take so long?
Agree. I mean, it should not take so long, but in the government's defense, a lot of these rules were set at a time when the economy moved much, much, much slower. For instance, many of our trade defense rules were established at a time when most of trade was goods shipped on ships that moved slowly, you know.
Right.
And most of the trade happened in the port. And the telex machine was the vanguard of ICT technology. So the economy moved a lot slower from a physical sense.
Well, we have to wrap up. Please join me in thanking Maureen Hinman, co-founder and executive chair of Silverado Policy Accelerator. Thank you so much for all the work you do today and all your public service.
Oh, thank you.
Great American.
You're a great American.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.